Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's time for our weekly check-in in the world of sports with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hi there, Bill.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay, so we have to talk about Pat Summitt.
I hope so, Bill.
Yeah, I mean, who else really in sports is there to talk about this week? The legendary basketball coach died yesterday. She was just 64, and in her 38 years as coach of the University of Tennessee Lady Vols, these numbers are just astonishing. She won 8 national championships, 1,098 games, the most by any Division I basketball coach, men's or women's, and could even boast a 100% graduation rate for her athletes. And she was diagnosed with early onset dementia back in 2011. So first of all, Bill, tell us, what does Pat Summitt mean for women's basketball?
Well, the easiest way, I think, to tell the story short form is that when Pat Summitt first took over the job, I think she was 22 years old, she took over the job as head coach of the women's team at Tennessee. She also drove the bus. Mm-hmm. She also washed the laundry. And that was the state of women's college basketball at that time. And she also was pursuing a master's degree because everybody figured, well, yeah, you'll have plenty of time to pursue a master's degree. What the heck are you doing just coaching women's basketball? It didn't mean anything. Now look at it. I mean, first of all, places like Tennessee and Connecticut and Stanford and Baylor and some of the other top women's teams, Stanford, they fill arenas, yeah, just like the most popular men's teams fill arenas. They're on national television. Their tournament is a big deal. Their best players are drafted into the WNBA, and they have pro careers. And when Pat Summitt started, there was no such thing. Right. Another interesting detail, I've written a little bit about this recently and kind of refreshed my own memory. When women's basketball was first included in the Olympics, Pat Summitt was coaching at Tennessee, and she said, cool, and was co-captain of the team and went off and played basketball in the Olympics. So that, you know, yeah, I can take some time off. What the heck? And they don't take time off now. Yeah. They're just like the coaches of the men's, yeah, team. They work year-round and they recruit all the time. And it's a big deal and a full-time job. And Pat Summitt is more responsible than anybody else for shepherding the game into, mm-hmm, the era that we're now enjoying.
And then you just reminded me that in, what, 1984, she coached the U.S. women's team to gold,
yes,
in the Olympics.
A bit of a revenge deal there because they got silver in the Olympics that she played in, lost to the team from the Soviet Union. Of course, in 1984, the Soviet Union didn't send a team. That was the era of dueling Olympic boycotts. But they did win the gold under her tutelage as coach.
Now, you did talk to Pat Summitt for Only a Game back in January of 2003. We have a little bit of tape of that, and that was after her 800th win, again in 2003. And you asked her if she missed the old days of Tennessee being the unrivaled greatest women's team in college basketball. And here's what she said.
Quite honestly, I'm excited about the parity. I think the parity speaks to the growth of women's basketball and the popularity. I think the fact that we have so many outstanding teams, we're seeing our fan base of those respective teams pick up. We're seeing television from coast to coast and a lot of new faces and new names to the game. And I feel really healthy and good as we continue to grow our sport.
Yeah. You know, Bill, one thing I wanted to add is we talked about the total 1,098 games she, mm-hmm, won, but I think, mm-hmm, the percentage is even more revealing. 84%.
Yeah, 84%. Not too many people can claim winning percentages like that. And, of course, a fair number of those games were won after, as Pat Summitt alluded to in that little bit that you played, after there were lots of other good teams.
Yeah. So let's talk about her rivalry with possibly the other biggest team in women's basketball with UConn.
Well, I mean, not possibly.
The,
without question.
The.
This is the colossus bestriding the game right
now. Because I read a story recently that a long time ago, Pat Summitt got a fish tank in her basketball offices at Tennessee, and she got two fish, and she named one Pat and the other Gino. And she'd walk into the office and check the tank and ask the secretaries cheerfully if Pat had eaten Gino yet.
Yeah, that sounds about right. They had a rivalry, no question about it. How could it have been otherwise? I think REM has won 11 national championships. Pat Summitt won 8 national championships. It couldn't have been otherwise. But I think it was the kind of rivalry that grew the sport, to use that popular verb probably inappropriately. It was the kind of rivalry that made everybody pay attention to women's basketball in a way that they had not previously done.
Yeah. So let's hear a little bit of tape of UConn's women's coach, Gino Arima, speaking to ESPN about Pat Summitt.
From the time I got to Virginia in 1981 to, you know, when Pat stopped coaching, I think she was the defining figure of the game of women's basketball. And, you know, lots of people coach the game, but very few get to define the game.
So Gino Arima really echoing a lot of what you just said, Bill, about Summitt's profound influence on the sport. But I want to play another bit of tape from Pat Summitt herself here. This is from a 2013 NPR interview, and she talks about her coaching philosophy.
You know, I think you can challenge people, but you don't want to break people down. But you've got to sometimes just pull them aside and say, you know, you're okay, but you can be better.
And then, Bill, she goes on to say you shouldn't stop, though, when someone really feels wobbly and starts crying.
Yeah, I love the fact that she says so quietly, you're okay, but you can be better.
Yeah.
Because I don't think she ever said it quite that quietly when she talked to a player on the sidelines or in the locker room. She tended to raise her voice no little and quite some. But I think the measure of not only her effectiveness as a basketball coach, but her effectiveness in influencing young women as they were growing up is apparent in the response all over social media from former players, people who so very much appreciated the enormous influence that she had on their lives.
Right. You know, back in 2012, President Obama himself recognized that influence when he awarded her the Presidential Medal of Freedom. So, you know, laudable.
Not a lot
praise
of coaches
there.
Get
yeah.
that sort of attention
yeah,
from
exactly.
the President of the United States.
So Bill helping us remember Pat Summitt, their legendary basketball coach at the University of Tennessee, who died this week at the age of 64. But Bill, before we wrap up, I want to switch gears here a little bit and talk about some cheerier news.
Not if you're in England.
I was going to say. But we do have that this news from the world of soccer. Let's listen. Translation, Iceland wins.
The translation is put your hands over your dog's ears.
Yeah.
I know. Iceland wins. And it's just a dreadful thing for England, having suffered, first of all, from perhaps the most confused exercise in suffrage that anybody has ever seen. I love the fact that people were Googling what is the European Union
after the Brexit.
After they voted to get out of it. But anyway, it's a big day for Iceland. Never, ever has the soccer team from Iceland enjoyed such prominence, and perhaps never has England enjoyed such shame on the soccer field. Or that, I'm only saying what the English are saying. One of the reporters in England was asked to sort of give people in the United States some sort of analogy so they could understand what had happened. And he said, well, it's as if we beat you in basketball.
Oh, my God. That drives the point home. Oh, my goodness. Tough week for England, but well done, Iceland. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, which airs on Saturdays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. here on WBUR. And he joins us on Wednesdays, Radio Boston, to talk sports. Thanks, as always, Bill.
A pleasure. Thank you, Meghna.
Nudity, when captured in art, is a celebration of the human body. When put on display in other places, such as online, it can be far less celebratory or attractive. Kathleen Morris is an interim senior curator at a Western Massachusetts museum that's now exploring how powerful and uncomfortable nude images can be.
Whether it's through the internet or through our entertainment avenues that are risque and erotic. And on the other hand, we come from very puritanical stock. And I think in America in particular, there's always been this kind of tension between those two impulses.
The new exhibition Morris helped put together at the Clark Art Institute in Williamstown explores how that tension played out in Spain during the repressive Inquisition. WBUR's Andrea Shea reports on the masterworks on loan from a museum in Spain for this exhibition entitled Splendor, Myth and Vision, Nudes from the Prado.
The first painting you see in the Clark's new exhibition is of the goddess Fortuna by Flemish artist Peter Paul Rubens. There's no shame on her fair-skinned face as she seems to move through the painting in her birthday suit.
She is nearly life-size, full-length, looking directly out at the viewer. This is Rubens's fleshy, robust, confident female nude.
That's Clark curator Laura Yeager-Crisselt. She says, like many of the nudes in this exhibition, Fortuna offers more than a bodacious body. That's how the Spanish kings who collected them saw her, too.
Fortuna represents fortune, chance, luck, fate. She is, the invariability of life. And Rubens shows her bouncing on a crystal ball in a stormy ocean, lightning breaking in the background. So, in fact, she became a source of contemplation for the rulers. So it's this way that the nude is able to operate on many different levels.
Yeager-Crisselt says those levels allowed royalty to collect these luscious, some might say lewd works. They're sensual, but also sophisticated and spiritual, depicting stories from mythology and the Bible. King Philip II, and later his grandson, Philip IV, had extreme tastes for top-notch nudes and commissioned them from some of the greatest artists in Europe. How they pulled it off in 16th and 17th century Spain reveals a complicated chapter in history. The Inquisition deemed nudity sinful, and Yeager-Crisselt notes that kings were expected to promote morality.
They were Catholic kings, and their roles publicly as representatives, as defenders of the Catholic Church, that public role had to coexist with their private taste.
This exhibition takes a scholarly deep dive into why and how kings collected, displayed, and at times even hid their nudes. They created special private spaces known as salas reservadas. King Philip IV hung Rubens's Fortuna in his hunting lodge.
The king was allowed in there, of course. Close members of the royal family who may have gone hunting with him. A very limited audience.
What about the queen?
The queen was not allowed. And we do have a reference in the earlier part of the 17th century that when the queen did go into a sala reservada, many of these paintings were covered up with a curtain.
Yeager-Crisselt says the private viewing rooms evolved over time, depending on who was in power. She and the other curators didn't know they existed until they started developing the show with the Prado Museum. King Philip II created a sala reservata in his palace called the Titian Vaults. One of the most provocative paintings in this show hung there, Venus with an organist and Cupid. In it, a skillfully rendered nude goddess reclines on a luxurious bed.
Venus is lounging, propped up on her side. Her full body is visible for us. There's a sense of softness to it. She has folds in her skin. She's thick in some places. All that she's wearing are jewels, pearls throughout her hair. I mean, she's just adorned by jewels and her own beauty and not much else.
A young musician sits at a pipe organ at the foot of her bed, craning his neck to stare.
He has paused from his playing. She is nude, and he's looking directly at her genitals, basically.
The paintings here aren't just of nude women. There are some barely clad males, too. One painting of Hercules shows the god from behind. His muscular backside is exposed and tensed as he raises a club to defeat his nude opponent. Quite a difference from the sultry, dimpled Venus, a point not lost on museum visitors Jean and Robert Poppy.
It's interesting to come into this room where there's the contrast between the sort of eroticism of the female figure as object and the male body as hero and strong and powerful.
Not that we have that in our society
today. No, of course not. No, completely foreign to us.
Another visitor, Rachel Cohan, understands how these nudes could be seen as a kind of highbrow porn for the powerful.
Of course, it sounds like pornography of the period of the Spanish Inquisition, right? On the other hand, they're painted by great artists, so there's a lot in them. But it is a really interesting contrast between the rigors of the Inquisition and the existence of these paintings and these guys collecting these paintings.
if they were understood or enjoyed in an erotic way, it doesn't mean I think they could also be enjoyed in a more intellectual way.
This is curator Jaeger Crisselt again.
And that's that ambivalence which exists on every level.
What is for sure, though, is that painting a nude was seen as the highest form of artistic achievement, and the kings who collected nudes knew that. By the end of the 17th century, the curator says the publicly pious Catholic monarchs were able to amass more than 5,000 paintings, most of them nudes, despite the Inquisition.
They were just so powerful that they were beyond it.
But not all of the Spanish kings had a thing for nudes. Philip III ordered them removed to protect his virtue. In the 18th century, Kings Charles III and IV tried to destroy the paintings. Court artists saved them in a sala reservada. If they hadn't stashed them away, these masterpieces might not be here to titillate onlookers centuries later in Williamstown.
That report from WBUR's Andrea Shea. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.